This episode of Inspiration Point is brought to you by the Quests and Chaos Podcast Network and the generous patrons over on patreon.com/inspirationpoint. So we'd like to give a big shout out to
Garlic Bread, Eric, and Spike.
And at our Muse $20 level, we'd like to thank
Prostaskius, Leroy, Kate, Jeremy, Jenna, Jacob, Falangor, Cheryl, A Bad Idea, Red Dead Coquette, and Robert Hans.
Thank you for helping us bring a little inspiration out into the world. And now, on with the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Inspiration Point. I'm Adam, and of course, I'm always joined with Tiana. Hey, how are you doing, Tiana?
Hi, I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Good. Good. Long time no talk.
You know, it's been five ever.
Five. All right. We are talking about designing a campaign from the ground up. And since it's going to be a little bit of doing, a little bit of talking about this thing, I thought we would just jump right in.
Yeah.
Last time we were talking about creating your theme, building a synopsis, thinking about your gameplay elements, using a mood board. We also talked about your political, economic, and religious core assumptions. And of course, other core assumptions that might exist in your world, such as its age, what its relationship with magic or technology is, so on and so forth. So if you want to get more details about that, we already talked about it in the previous episode.
And we are also providing the campaign document in the show notes so that you can follow along and, like, make notes in the margins of your own copy.
Yeah, make your own copy, go ahead and start filling it out, and then erase everything and start over again, because, of course,
the first draft is never right.
The first draft is never right. And, of course, I'd be interested to hear if there are other ideas out there on how to improve the document. What could we do without? What should be added? That sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Because this is by no means, you know, the definitive thing. This is just what I feel like I need, right, to get where I need to be. And this is what I do require of students. So the next section we're going to talk about are the player characters themselves. And of course, you're going to need to know them. Yep. You're going to need to know what you're dealing with in order to get into the real big stuff. So,
because the player characters are the main characters. Like,
they're the main
characters. Nothing is built without them. So they're pretty central to all of this.
They're extremely central. I have a bad habit of creating infinite NPCs when maybe just giving more information to a player would make more sense, or just to an existing NPC, even.
Sure.
Now, everything we've made up until this point helps you get to that all-important session zero.
Mm-hmm.
But we really can't go a whole lot further until we have those players, because the story, of course, is going to be about them, okay? And the story that the synopsis that we have provided so far is loose enough that we can go ahead and wrap in whatever our players provide us with.
Yeah, in the sense of like improv theater, those are the given circumstances. Those are the, you know, four words from the crowd that you have pulled in that you can now start to structure everything else around.
Precisely correct. Okay, so I've set up this simple little table, this little chart, if you will, and on the leftmost side, I have the image of a character, right? So a portrait of them. Maybe that's the token they use, or just a piece of concept art they found. Or if they're an artist, you know, maybe they made you something.
Sure.
I sure like to do that when I'm in a game. Then the second thing is character information. So things that we want to know, such as name, personality, player type, goals, etc. And this is where I might point out that very near the beginning of the Dungeon Master's Guide, it talks about player types. But even if you're not playing Dungeons and Dragons specifically, understanding your player archetypes is super important. For instance, if I don't have an explorer in my group, I might have to go back and rethink some of the things that we talked about last time, because I'm definitely thinking of an exploration heavy game, and that would be really good for some players, but not every player wants that. Some of them just want to get to the dialogue ASAP, right?
Right.
And so maybe if that were the case, I might make some alterations. You know, how much do they want combat? How much do they want to investigate? Do they like puzzles? Do they like riddles? Do they, you know, what do they want? What, you know, again, we've already had an episode talking about all those types before. So you can check that out or read the DMG.
We recommend both.
Yeah, of course. Of course. But, you know, make sure that you know what their goals are. Ask them straight out, like, what kind of fantasy do you want here? Mm-hmm. Like illustrate for me the big moment of your character. Like, what might that sort of feel like? You know, is this you plunging the final blow of the sword into the heart of the dragon, you know, while leaping over the lava pit? You know, is this kicking open the doors and interrupting the wedding? You know, is this you having a John Wick moment where, you know, you come from the dead and then you just shoot everyone in sight? You know, let me know what those things are, because if you don't ask straight out, you may not be able to pick up on it.
Right.
Here, we really can't pre-write this, right? We have to sit down and we have to make some characters. So, Tiana, make me a character.
Oh, God.
But not just a character. Make me a player, right? Since we don't have the ability to do this right now, because I don't have extra people to do this with, I want you to make up a player that is likely to occur.
Huh.
All right, I'll get you started. First one, his name's John.
Okay? Oh, God. Bog standard person. Cool.
It wasn't that helpful.
So helpful. I appreciate you so much. All right. John.
John really likes, what player type is John?
I think I had to actually pull open the player types because I didn't remember what they were. I think that John is a combination of the fighter and the optimizer.
Okay, fighter, optimizer. Okay, that is a very likely thing to happen, right? This guy wants to get in the thick of it, and he's thought about his DPR calculations.
Yes.
And all that good stuff.
Okay. And absolutely has their character sheet built out, like, with all of the choices that they're going to make all the way up to 20th level. And they have a very set plan of what they want to do.
Okay, so what is their sort of central fantasy or goal that they want?
I think that they want to have, like, the cool guy moments in a big combat. They want to be able to get the really cool plate armor. They want to get the magic sword of, you know, like a Vorpal sword or something fun like that.
Cool.
They want to, they're after, like, cool moments and great gear.
I think that's great. We could almost build out their entire build
easily
now and then just sprinkle it through the campaign. Fantastic. Okay. Then on the right side, the rightmost column, this is where we would put things like reference stats, like really mm-hmm. quick things, like the most important mean like AC and passive perception, right? Like,
yeah.
I think those would be the number ones. But you might even put the ability scores, or if you want to just do like race, class, background, whatever.
Yeah.
Right? As much information as you want, but keep it small.
Yeah. I actually have combat trackers that I use that have things like their maximum amount of hit points, their AC, their passive perception, so that if I have a trap that I want that they may or may not trigger, for example, I'll glance at their passive perception and be like, nope, their passive perception is below that. Ping!
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so that's super important to keep track of. Okay, then give me a second player. Again, I'm going to help you out. This is Alex, they, them.
Alex, they, them. Okay. Alex is, I believe, more of an explorer storyteller blend.
Okay. Explorer storyteller. And what is their fantasy?
Their fantasy is to be able to have that like really dramatic speech that is able to, like, turn the tide of a moment where, like, you know, they're able to march into the big church and like throw down verbally with the high priest and win verbally.
Excellent. Excellent. That's cool. We can absolutely work with that moment. Okay. And then we could do all the stats. Okay. Then we'll just do one more player. This is Tiffany. She, her.
Tiffany is almost pure actor, but with sprinklings of instigator.
Definitely the kind of person.
Yeah. Definitely the kind of person who plays a chaos alignment of some variety.
Very good. Very good. Okay. And what's her big moment?
I think her big moment, whether she wants to admit to it or not, is when she gets a really funny or really cool crit fail that everyone talks about for ages afterwards. Like, she goes to kick open a door and she rolls a nat one on a door. and it's the moment that it becomes a meme in the group.
Okay, so she's there for the memes and the dreams, right? But also she's an actress. So she wants to have those moments of acting, of course. But she's also going to get bored quickly if we don't keep things a-moving.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Amy over on Quest of Chaos is very much this kind of person, much more instigator than actor, and absolutely got things moving at one point when we were playing Call of Cthulhu and we showed up in Egypt and she started a fight on the docks. And then went to a person and said, I could make that happen to you. Tell us where the best hotel is for us.
I definitely appreciate a healthy amount of instigation.
Yeah. Because, I mean, like, another way to, like, divide players in a very simple binary is reactive and proactive. And I think you need a healthy blend of both. But you really do need the proactive to, like, kick the door open or else you're just going to sit there making plans for 5 hours.
Okay, so... all in all, you know, just looking at all these characters together, what do you see that we should focus on and what we could probably ignore?
I chose those types deliberately so that there would be a healthy blend of exploration and combat and character moments for the three pillars. I think of those, combat might be a little bit lower just because there's only one person who is super like, I want to go break all of the things. You still need to have like the moments of that because if you don't, you're going to lose your fighter.
Right.
But it's going to be mostly focused, I think, on the dramatic like social moments and exploration.
Yeah. So I might hold back on a lot of puzzles. The puzzles might just be more like environmental backdrop stuff, you know, where you gotta like push the rock onto the water in order to climb the thing or whatever.
I have discovered just how much I hate puzzles when I played a video game called A Little to the Left. It's very cute and it brought me to tears of frustration.
Oh, yeah. No, every time I'd play a Persona game, I'd hand the controller off to my wife to do the puzzle for me. I just don't want to fiddle with it. I'm trying to date Makoto, not like do rocket science over here.
Yeah. So,
so we can think about what to focus on and what not to, and in this story we can go back and refine as needed because now we know who we're dealing with, right? And of course it gets more complex as we add players. Mm-hmm. And I do not recommend any group larger than six. I think six is my absolute upper limit where anything beyond that I'm going to get frustrated. I think everybody else is going to get frustrated, and it's just not going to work.
Yeah, I'm currently
running.
I think four
and five are perfect.
I agree. I'm currently running a game that technically has five players, but because one of the players has to travel as much as she does, we really have four consistent players and one player who comes in and plays whenever she can. I actually like built a mechanic around her being able to get snatched out whenever she needed to not be there.
You know, speaking of building mechanics around characters, you know, one thing you definitely want to look at is their profession. Make sure that the smith gets to smith something, right? Make sure that the cook gets to cook something. Make sure that this stuff can come up and that they can be useful. And only concentrate on those systems because all the other ones don't need to exist.
Right.
Right. If your players aren't doing it, we don't care. Okay. So you don't need to write a cartography system and a, you know, woodworking system if nobody cares, right?
Yeah. These are things that are happening because they happen in the world, but they can happen in the background and only come up when they become important.
Correct. And this can create interesting plot hooks that you can use. Like if we're talking about dealing with a rogue shield guardian, right? Mm. If your smith might be very interested in getting those parts, right? Or if you have someone who's interested in golems or mechs or something, an artificer might find that very, very fascinating. So this is a good way to tempt them.
Come over here. Let's look at this.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, it's also important, kids, to realize when certain things are being put into the game and certain plot hooks are being created that are for specific players.
Uh-huh.
And and then to respect that and then to help them have that. Okay. Very important.
Everyone wants to get the cool moments, and I think that it is much more powerful when the players help amplify those moments for the other players and trust that when it's like their moment, the other players will amplify you.
So this is what I would call positive metagaming, mm-hmm. right? Where you're aware of what the GM's doing, you're aware of who it's for, and you're going to help facilitate that.
Exactly. And that's super important in acting. That's, you know, that's throwing the focus where it's like, oh, it's not my scene. A bad choice would be blah, 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 my lines, blah, 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 my lines. It is much more interesting and engaging if you can throw the focus, help amplify it, even if you're not talking, just, you know, really underline what's happening in the scene. And yeah, sometimes that's throwing memes into the Discord channel to emphasize what you're hearing.
Yeah. Which, by the way, as a GM, I love that so much. And especially since I don't look at them right away. And so like at the end of the session, I get like this huge like scrolling list of memes that reviews the entire session for me.
You could look at it and just know what happened all the way through. Like I always wonder what those look like to people who aren't in the campaign. I know Andrew used to watch Wrath of the Scorned memes pop up and like react to some of them.
I know, yeah. I hope I can get Andrew back in a game someday.
That'd be great.
That'd be great. I get he needs some time.
Yep.
But one of these days, we got to get him back.
We love you, Andrew. We miss you.
Absolutely. Come back to the dark side. Okay. Anything to add about early player consideration? Or do you think we pretty much got the broad strokes?
I think we have the broad strokes. I think I'll just reemphasize that this should always be a dialogue between mm-hmm. you and the players. Like we talk about like building up to the session zero, but before the session zero, I feel like the GM should know what it is exactly that the players are here for.
Correct.
So I mentioned previously about the Google Doc that you sent out. I think that's just good practice to be able to be able to ask, what are you guys looking for? So that it's a big time saver for the GM because then you're not spending a bunch of time preparing things that will never get touched on because that isn't what the players want to do.
Yeah, I 100% agree. The one advice I want to throw onto that, though, is a mistake I made, which is don't put options there that you yourself aren't interested in.
Yeah, if you aren't interested in it, don't do that.
Yeah, so I was like trying to be cool and thorough. And then people all picked something I was already doing. And I was like, I don't want to do that. But they picked it. You know? So careful, careful. With this last game, I don't think I did send out a form for Westgate. I think I said, here's what it's going to be. Mm-hmm. But then we had a very, very robust session zero.
Yeah, using all of those session zero techniques that we talked about previously.
Correct. Yeah. And so I think that was kind of the makeup. But in that case, I kind of knew who I was dealing with and what the relationships were to each other and kind of what they wanted from the game.
And, yeah, because you had already been dealing with me, Kate, Pro, and Leroy for, you know, a couple of years before that. And then you had already played with Tanya and you know Chris really well. So when they got folded in, you kind of already knew what you were dealing with.
Yeah. And everyone in that group is super easy to work with. Like, and you know, you guys are often sending me stuff. You sent me something today, this morning.
Yep.
Asking about stuff for Hakoi.
Yep.
And, you know, I get stuff from Tanya pretty often, which is great, you know, without it being like overwhelming. So yeah, I appreciate that.
Like if I have thoughts, I'll send you one or two paragraphs. I try not to write you a treatise.
A wall. Yeah.
Because I know how overwhelming it is to get that wall of text. And it's just I don't want to deal with this.
I just don't have the attention span. I can't do it.
I don't have the spell slots to deal with that.
Yeah, I can't. Okay, so moving on from players, the DMG brings us pretty quickly into creating our first settlement. And of course, I would be remiss if I didn't mention spectacular settlements designed by our friend Andrew.
Yeah.
But having said that, the DMG itself has a much more succinct list, right, that will kind of get you to what you need right now, whereas spectacular settlements is going to give you something a lot more detailed and rich.
Right.
But it's also going to be very lengthy, right? And so, you know, pick your poison when it comes to this. I actually do the old school technique with my students. I have them get a bunch of dice in hand and roll them onto the piece of paper. And then those are our buildings. And then we draw the settlement based on what you land. And if you want to go even further, you can assign all the numbers, different building types, and then boom, you know exactly what you have. Either way, it's good to have a home base, right?
Yes.
This is our Tristram. This is our inn. This is the hunting lodge. This is the watering hole, right? And so this is a very important place to start. Even if we're not going to be here all that often, the important thing about the settlement is it gives us people to care about.
Yeah.
And it gives us things to care about and a central sort of sense of identity in terms of location. So this is where you might have various allies and patrons, maybe even villains, that are working with / against you. And I really like, there's this video game called Kingdom Come Deliverance. And it was like a very realistic medieval sort of adventure RPG game. Okay. Where your character is like a peasant who is like a blacksmith's son, and you are completely illiterate and you have had absolutely no weapon training whatsoever. You know, you basically just fetch things, right? And so you're like, your first quest is just going and buying some charcoal from somebody. Right. And you deal with like the town bullies, but, you know, they're just town bullies. They're not like evil.
BBEGs.
Right. Yeah. No. And you deal with a lot of little things, and it's fun. Like you look at books and it's all jumbled, and then you get your reading skill up and it's like a little less jumbled and so on and so forth. But anyway, they really get you to know that settlement well and to connect you with the characters in a pretty short amount of time. Before absolutely destroying everything.
Of course. You have to break it.
You have to break it. Yeah, number one, get them to care. Number two, break it. So you don't have to have a million features. I think a GM could get overwhelmed pretty easily here, where if they try to like, okay, I'm going to build the city of whatever, and then we're going to build like five different districts, and each district's going to have like 100 notable locations. Right.
If that settlement is where you're setting everything, fine, because that's what you did with Westgate. But if this is meant to be like home base that you come back to, then you don't need to go into that much detail.
Well, also, Westgate was already built, right?
That helps.
All I've really had to do is, you know, plug in the wiki information, you know, and then where it's a little more barren, maybe I add my own thing. But the majority of those locations are still not built out, right?
They don't need to be.
Most of them are still just a title, right? Like, I kind of know what their general purpose is, but beyond that, I have nothing because that's not where our magnifying glass is right now, right? Yeah. Right now, we are focusing mostly on that like church district where we had the different temples that you guys were involved with. So those locations are built out because that's where our central focus is. And so this is where kind of like your middle out design happens because you're thinking, okay, well, what do the players care about right now? And so let's put some detail there, but let's not overwhelm ourselves with superfluous detail that might come up, if that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly.
So I make students give me at least 7 features that are in this settlement, which, I mean, a feature could be something as simple as there's a well, right? Or something as complex as here's the blacksmith's house and this is where his family lives and blah, 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 blah. And here's his, you know, shopping list of offerings. You know, here's the big tree that everyone likes and has carved their names into over the course of generations, right?
Oh, that's cute.
So, something like that. You know, they can vary in terms of importance and detail. Yeah, so I want to do a Spelljammer game, and I have used this element before a couple of times, but my Spelljammer game that I want to do is Truckers in Space, pretty much.
Okay.
And where the settlement, the main settlement is Flows, okay? And it's a space diner on an asteroid. All right. And Flo is a GIF who, you know, has the curlers and she's wearing the muumuu.
Yes.
And she's always like calling you child and stuff like that.
Oh, I love her.
But also she's an absolute gangster.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Like, she is a hard ass, but has this like exterior that's nice. But she is like the central hub. She's the neutral territory. Everyone knows not to cause trouble at Flo's. But this is also where you get all your quests and stuff. This is where you can have a discussion with your enemy without it resulting in a fight.
Because if you fight, man, Flo will kick you out.
Yeah, and if you can't get access to Flo's, well, it's a really long distance to the next station, so you're probably going to run out of fuel before you can get there. Also, you're going to lose like all kinds of other connections. And so that's my settlement. And it has a big, gaudy neon sign.
Of course.
That sticks out and it flashes and breaks every now and then. But yeah, I really like this concept. And most of the quests are take this cargo and put it there.
Well, sure. I mean, that's a pretty decent, like, a fetch quest is not a bad thing to build around.
No. Like, the reason why we get all these rough looking types to do it is because this is dangerous work. Because there's space vampires, there's plasmoids, there's Githyanki, there's astral elf supremacists, there's monkey people, there's...
Hidozi, they're called Hidozi.
Yeah, those ones. There's space clowns, guys. There are space clowns. This shall not stand.
There's so many interesting things in the Spelljammer, universe, multiverse, whatever you want to call it. It's pretty great.
100%. 100%. So, settlements also are very useful to give you someone to save. This is a huge part of heroic fantasy that for some reason often gets looked over, right? Let your players save a cat. Let them save a child. Let them rescue somebody, right?
Yeah.
And feel like they did that.
Let them have deep connections, like, because these are connections that you can exploit later. Dan likes to say that on our Delta Green sheet, the bonds are people that have targets on their backs because they are people who are important to the character. And if you want to mess with the character, the fastest way to do that is to hit them in the heart.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. Step one, make them care. Step two, threaten the thing they care about.
Yep. And that gives them the immediate instinct of this is important to me. I will protect it. And then it has this beautiful positive feedback loop.
100%. Okay, so that's pretty much settlement. I could go into more detail than that, but this is not about settlements, right?
Correct.
So the next thing that I have is the plot outline itself. And I like to use the classic three-act structure to understand this. If you want to go into more detail, I like Dan Harmon's story circle. I've talked about that before on the show. Back in the first season, I'm sure Andrew and I talked about the hero's journey, right? And went through all those stages. And there's a lot to be said there. It all pretty much nestles right into the three-act structure, the beginning, the middle, and the end. Mm-hmm. The ordinary world, the strange world, and then the return. And so if you want to get to know those act structure elements in more detail, we do have episodes on that stuff. Or you can go to the bazillion things on YouTube and otherwise.
There's a lot of places in where people have discussed various kind, like there's Skillshare lessons on this. If you really want to get deep into plotting, there's all kinds of YouTube videos of people talking about that sort of thing. There's essays galore. There's a lot of information on how to plot. You know, it's usually about books, but there's a lot out there for RPG campaigns too.
So this is tricky in what we're doing though, because we're not writing a screenplay, right?
Right.
We're not in control of all the elements. So you have to keep this fairly loose. But at the very top of the page, I have first a restatement of the campaign theme.
Yeah.
Because plot and theme, again, are not the same thing. And this is where people really get messed up. I'll ask a student, what is your campaign about? And they'll start saying something like, a dragon disguised as a human infiltrates a kingdom, and then with 10 stones of dragon scale power, they have spread these like seeds across the world, which have grown into other dragons that... And Tiana's looking away right now and is bored because all of this plot nonsense is boring.
Right.
Right? It sucks. Yeah. Like, I don't like to hear about people's plots and characters because it's usually all of this surface level nonsense. And I'm not, you know, not to say that's not part of the fantasy, right?
Well, it very much is, but that's not the first part. That's not where you start. You have to start with what does it all mean and why is it important?
So if there's going to be a dragon, what does a dragon mean? What does it represent? You said 10 scales. Why are there 10? What is the significance of the number 10? Are they different? Are they the same? Why did we spread them out? Why didn't we just find somebody to give them to? You know, we can, again, look back on our theme to go, how do I make anyone care about this stuff? You know, because the things that we care about are the primal instinct things.
Mm-hmm.
We care about conflict. We care about love. We care about territory. We care about food. We care about, basically the most base instinct type things that humans have. You have to have these things. Even if we're dealing with something like, even if your theme is incredibly philosophical, in order to get us to care about it, we still have to understand it on the caveman level, if that makes sense.
So, to pull back a little bit, what was the theme of Wrath of the Scorned?
So, Wrath of the Scorned asks a simple question, what is love?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, because Aphrodite herself didn't even understand it.
And she was the embodiment of love, but what did that mean?
But she didn't understand it until she had her relationship with Bahamut.
Mm-hmm.
And not that he taught her that, but...
But he did.
How can you learn love in the environment of Olympus?
Hmm.
It was pretty much impossible. Hephaestus himself was made without love, without the process of lovemaking. He is built entirely from Hera's spite.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's rejected. And then he still picks himself up, you might say, by his bootstraps.
So to speak.
And then he makes something of himself and he presents it, and then he's rejected. And so then he forces his hand, and he gets what he thinks he wants, right? But again, he is further scorned by Aphrodite and Ares going behind his back. And then he catches them, and he does the dumbest thing possible, which is to say, everyone look at how unfaithful she is.
Yeah, which really only underlined that he was the nice guy.
He was cuckolded, right? Yeah. And that was, of course, more embarrassing for him than anything else. But, you know, then we have to look at Aphrodite's relationship to what's going on as well. And that she's not just some popular girl with the jock, right? She's missing too. I mean, imagine being the aspect of love and then never seeing it, never experiencing it. Zeus isn't teaching it.
Yeah.
Ares sure isn't teaching it.
God, no.
You know, we're very familiar with war. We have like three war gods, right?
Yep.
We're doing the heck out of war. But
what is love?
But what is love? We don't know. And so the themes of everything were basically different versions of toxic relationships.
Hmm.
You know, and every now and then we get a sprinkling of positivity and good relationships of, you know, do we have, you know, someone like the kobold buddy, I already forgot his name.
Zrex?
Zrex, that's right. Zrex, you know, who's just an absolute doormat and commands no respect. You know, that's not love, that's codependency, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, not to...
Yeah. No, I'm always fascinated by that because, like, I am a writer, but I have been a fan fiction writer longer than I've been any other kind of writer. So, like, I haven't had to create my own thing terribly often. So, but I've been thinking a lot about, like, themes and things like that because of a booktuber that I follow who really underlines that. Like, what is your theme? What is it about? So, It fascinates me. I'm endlessly fascinated by this.
Love is also one of those things that it's, like, hard to define. Like,
it really is.
You know, because it's like, well, it's just animal instinct to procreate. Well, it's like, well, yeah,
but it's also
but also there's these other things that are involved, but it's not involved, right? Like, so.
Well, and also there's love that asexual or demisexual people have that is not necessarily about like that procreation. And then what is that?
Yeah, what does that look like? That's a whole other thing. We just barely touched on that with Artemis existing, but we didn't get very far.
I adore Artemis. Artemis is genuinely my favorite of the Greek gods.
I think everybody found my version of her comical, but we didn't get too deep.
I didn't find her comical. I found her really, really relatable, where it's like, this is the thing that I'm good at, and you're pulling me out of my comfort zone, and I'll do it because it's the right thing to do, but also, I really just want to get back into the woods, man.
Yeah, I don't like peopling.
Yeah, peopling's hard, and I am an introvert, so I absolutely get her.
So, anyway, I felt like people got it because at the end of that campaign, the thing that really made that campaign special was the resolution that I didn't write. You know, it was everyone getting together and hugging it out, right? Like sparing Hephaestus.
And giving him the ability to feel love like that. Leroy's character giving up that godhood to give him the one thing that he couldn't get otherwise. Ah, I was crying at that. That was precious.
That's the good shit. The good stuff, man. I mean, that's what it's all about, man. Like, yeah, Hephaestus, forge god, cool. Okay, but sad guy that doesn't know what love is, like, you know, that's stuff we can get, you know. We've all experienced that unreturned love or that feeling of not understanding a concept that everyone else seems to think is so important, right? Anyway, so all the plot, all the different dragons that you fought and ran around with, they don't matter at all. They don't, nobody cares, right? What they care about is what they represent.
they were means to an end and part of telling the story, but they were still important in that aspect. Like, they needed to fit into the plot because that was, you know, it was a very dragon-centric campaign, that
yes.
one.
Well, Fizzbands had come out. We were all super excited about Fizzbands, right? And so that played a huge role. So yeah, it was, what if Tiamat invaded Olympus? That was pretty much the plot version, which is kind of dumb on its own, right? Like, if I said, well, that's what it's about, like, entirely, that's boring.
If that was the theme, that would be boring. But that being the plot is interesting, which is a very interesting differentiation.
Most plots are dumb sounding when you take them out of context, right?
Truly.
Like, most of them aren't very interesting, but try not having a plot, right?
Right. Most plots have been done to death. Like, Stephen King made the joke in the Dark Tower series that there's only, like, 19 stories in existence, and just every story is a retelling of those 19 stories. But it's how you tell it and what it means to you that is important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so just a quick overview of how the different acts are structured. Act one is the establishment of life as it is. Okay, so since in the last episode we talked about how this world was going to center around an oppressive theocracy, and so we need to establish that. Mm-hmm. We're gonna have a scene where we see oppression happen. We're going to see ways in which we participate in our own oppression.
Yeah.
We are going to go through the regimented day in a life, right, before we really get into going off to face the dragons.
Yeah,
right?
You have to set the status quo before you can break it.
Correct, correct. During that establishment, you can foreshadow, in fact, you should, okay, but it should be small and almost unnoticed, right? Someone might say, well, that's kind of odd. That's kind of strange.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't expect that, you know, but they might keep that in the back of their mind, and that's going to help hint at what's to come. And then when it comes, it makes sense, right? It doesn't feel random.
Yeah. It's a twist that makes you go, oh, that's what that meant.
That's what that meant. And then you are training your player to look for things in your game, right? And then they will begin to find things you did not plan.
And then those are the ones that you can steal and use as a jumping off point, especially
Correct.
When they make the wonderful mistake of plotting in front of you or red stringing in front of you.
Correct. And then you're like, and the GM's just writing down notes.
Uh-huh.
Right?
And probably like picking up the 17 pages that they wrote previously and just yeeting it over their shoulder to be like, nope, that's better. I'm using that.
And by the way, guys, don't be like Hollywood in the last few years where fans figure out your theory, so you just rewrite it just so it's surprising.
Yeah.
But your surprise is dumb.
Don't do that. It's so visible when you've done that.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So something happens in Act One. You might call it the inciting incident. And then we can no longer just exist here. Something happens. We have to go leave the settlement. We have to leave home. We have to leave the planet, life as it's known, whatever. We have to enter the dark, mysterious forest. And we said last time that the forests were banned. Right?
Yeah.
But there's some kind of sickness happening. You know, it's like Moana's island is great. They have everything they need until suddenly they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, all the fish are dead and rotten. All the plants, all the crops are dying.
And the darkness is coming.
The darkness is coming. So, and Dad is still saying, don't do anything about it. Well, it's like, you're going to be queen of nothing, you know, if you let that happen. So Moana does the heroic thing and then goes out to find the source of the darkness.
Aided and supported by her mother and pushed along by her grandmother.
Yeah, yeah. Grandma doing a lot of heavy lifting in this case.
you do sometimes need the person to just kick you in the back, in the seat of the pants, and say, you need to go do the thing, go be a hero.
Well, and that gets us into things like character archetypes. She's obviously the mentor of the story, right?
Yeah.
The teacher, the person that you go and speak with in order to get your quest. The magician in the tarot. mm-hmm. who gives you the tools that you need in order to embark on the fool's journey, you know, whatever it is. So when we go into Act Two, we've left all these things behind. This is about half your campaign. Now, for a D&D campaign, Act Two is super long. It's probably most of your game, to be honest.
Yeah, because Act One is the setup and then the insight and incident. Act Two is everything else as you're discovering what the actual problem is. You're figuring out, like, what can be done about it. Can anything be done about it? You're meeting people, you're exploring, you're finding allies, you're doing the Dragon Age Origin thing of, like, gathering your resources.
Correct.
And then Act Three is where, like, you have gotten to the point of, like, okay, let's do this.
The midpoint of Act Two is something called the Crisis. Mm. And it is pretty much the fake climax, right? It is where you think you've solved the problem, but you didn't solve the problem.
Yeah.
Right? There's something else that is the true issue that we have to deal with, or the next layer in the cake, you know, whatever. That's when we get to Act Three. We have to take everything that we've learned and everything that we've gained, our magic sword, all that stuff, and we need to finally defeat our big bad and then return home and have a dance off.
Or you're too damaged and heartsick to be able to return home. You have changed so much, but the place that you're from has not. And then you go off into the Undying Lands, whatever that end looks like for you.
Right. Sail off out of Middle Earth. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever it is you got to do. Yeah. Maybe you can't go home again. Or maybe you're like Balto and you bring the medicine home for all the children. Right. It's true, hero. Whatever you need it to be. And of course, your party can split to the four winds, as maybe one of them goes home and another one marries Lazelle and flies off into space. You know, whatever it is, you know, stuff happens.
You know, family is the people that you find along the way, and sometimes it's a terrifying get Yankee.
Yeah, speaking of overused stories, but also still totally valid, is the found family story. It's just so popular these days.
It's so good.
It's really relating to a lot of people. Makes you wonder why that might be.
Can't imagine. Maybe most of us are broken in some horrible way.
Anyway, back to the theocracy.
Yeah.
Okay. So with each of those, I also encourage my students to include an image just to give them some inspiration for every one of the acts. Okay. So, at this point is when we get into, yes, but we're playing Dungeons & Dragons.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so, if you're not playing Dungeons & Dragons, your experience may vary. I'm going to use D&D as the example because it's the one I know the best.
Sure.
So, this is where I create a flow chart that breaks down my acts into my sort of gameplay structure. And this is something that I really like about BioWare games, at least in its heyday. You know, where it was like, okay, step one, you're in the tutorial level, mm-hmm. right? This is our establishment. Maybe it's your origin if we're doing Dragon Age Origins. Okay, step two, another sort of central, you have to do this kind of quest. And now we understand what our main topic is and what we're really going to be doing. We enter Act Two. There's three planets, three locations, five locations, whatever it is. You're going to go to them all, but you can pick the order, right?
Yeah.
And then halfway through one of the second one, we're going to have this interlude where someone shows up and wrecks everything.
Yeah.
And then that's going to fundamentally change the next two locations or whatever, right? So that's kind of how BioWare does it. And then, of course, it brings it all together at the end and you use the collection of all your choices to do something. So what I have done here is, this is a little bit more mechanical, where I know what my theme is, I know what my plot is. Now I need two things. I need dungeons, and I need dragons.
Yeah, and they don't need to literally be dungeons or dragons, but they do need to be a place that you go to explore and get things and kill monsters, and it needs to be some big monster to kill or treat with.
So the act leads to the dungeon or dungeons, okay? So in Act One, we're establishing town. We got that. And then the village elder says, hey, go do a thing. What does he ask you to do? What do you think? Something for level one, two, or three.
Probably something. There's a big festival that happens every year in the town square, and someone needs to go and collect a particular item in order to make the dish that this village is particularly well known for.
Okay, so we're going to accompany them to the shrine on the hill.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll give that shrine a neat name, but then there's trouble that happens, and it's really strange. This is also part of our foreshadowing. Sorry, just sticking drawing terms in. Our foreshadowing is we're going up, and it's like there's not supposed to be undead here. There's not supposed to be dark spirits or whatever. Why are there thorns and vines covering the flower I need? You know, what in the heck is going on here?
Yeah, something is wrong, and I don't understand it.
But whatever, we go through then the next branch, which are encounters. So, you know, if you're drawing out your whole dungeon, maybe you have many encounters. I like the magic number three, that even if you are doing kind of a sprawling dungeon, that there are three main events that happen within that dungeon, right? Everything else is sort of on the side or in support of or optionals, you know, not necessarily superfluous, but like they're just more flavor and exploration. But really, we're worrying about these three things.
Okay.
Right. So what are three quick encounters that you can think of that might exist on this first foray into our adventure?
Well, I think that if the goal is to get them to go into the dark, scary forest to find out things, I think that nature itself is twisted in some way.
Great. So maybe we have a dryad. Attack. Dryads aren't particularly strong, but they are mysterious and they're not supposed to be evil like that, right? So that would let us know that, hey, something's up.
Something's wrong. So there's some like twisted version of a good thing or, you know.
Dire animals could also
dire
be.
Dire animals. Like I was thinking like an elk that has like thorns twisted into its antlers.
That would be awesome, right? Like half of its face is like just got like more horns coming out or whatever.
Yeah, like, it is like very visibly malformed and mutated in a way that it's like, this doesn't happen naturally. What happened?
Yeah, that is really cool. And then maybe one more.
I think that when they get to where the thing is, I like your idea of things being grown up and over. It's kind of like the thorns around Sleeping Beauty's tower.
Yes.
Where it's like, this is a thing that we have come to every year to get this thing in this place, and it's wrong. What happened?
What happened, right? And so it's more about destroying the thorns, and maybe there's a threat there that we actually can't beat at the current level. So it's really about getting away from them while going through this obstacle course, right? And then getting the item. And of course, we have to get the item out.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's a whole other thing. And so at this point, we have completed our first dungeon. We go back to the settlement. We say something's wrong. The higher-ups tell us nothing's wrong. This is fine. You didn't see what you really thought you saw.
There is no war in Ba Sing Se.
Yeah, exactly. And then you go, well, what are we going to do, guys? You know? And then Grandma, who's a troublemaker, shows up and says, yeah, you should go to the thing and do the thing. Isn't that forbidden? Who cares? Then you're like, okay, Grandma, let's go.
Yeah, it's forbidden, but the consequences of not doing it could be very high.
Correct. So then we interact to, maybe this is a mega dungeon, maybe there's a couple of quote-unquote dungeons involved, maybe there's three, maybe there's more, right? But there's X amount of dungeons. Again, it all needs to be on theme. They each need to have their featured encounters and so on and so forth. And then we probably have one more for Act 3 as we come into the actual climax of the game. So right before the very end of the game, we should have our final battle or whatever that conflict looks like. And then a little bit of epilogue and the game's over.
And there it is, you know, bish, bash, bosh. There's your story.
There's your story, right? But also in game form.
Yeah.
Right? And you don't over detail every one of these because, again, you're going to lock yourself down. Mm-hmm. You're going to lose motivation. You're going to overwork yourself early on. So you gotta say, okay, here's basically what's happening. What else is there? I don't know. And that's okay.
Yeah.
Right? We'll get to it when we get to it. It's really important to do an outline like this because you don't want to end up over-designing. If you end up like just waiting week to week to week to week to do things and you're just like last minute planning all the time, but you don't have a plan, it's going to, your story is going to feel more like, and then, and then, and then, and then.
And those are such boring stories.
Because they're boring stories as opposed to therefore, 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 right? Or which leads to. So those are the events we want. So you have to, you want that creativity, but you also have to have the discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have creativity and discipline together.
Oh, it's beautiful.
That's when you're a GM, my dude. That's because you are game master, okay?
Mm.
Game, fun, master, discipline, right? You have to have those two things together. Otherwise, your game feels either A, meaningless, or B, incredibly stifling.
Very well said. I don't have anything to add to that. That is a fantastic way to look at it, where it's the fun and the discipline. I hadn't ever thought of it that way.
Yeah, you got to have both, man. Like, you know, I love my kids and I want to buy them everything, uh-huh. Right? You want to, like, you get a young person you care about, you just want to shower them with all their hopes and dreams. And it's like, well, A, I don't have the money for that. And B, what are they learning, right? What are they expecting? You know, how am I changing them for my own desire, right?
Yeah.
Like, no, it's better to say, hey, you do the thing, you get the thing, right? That's going to be more meaningful to them, right? And mm-hmm. even though you bought the thing 3 weeks ago and it's sitting in the garage, right?
And you so desperately want to give it to them.
Correct. Yeah, you want to give it to them, right? But you hold off. You wait till Christmas, man,
yep.
Because otherwise you screw it up. So anyway, that's kind of how I look at it. After that, we get into really the nitty-gritty detail. So I think that this is a good part to kind of leave off on.
I agree. And we can dive into the deeper details next time on Dragon Ball Z.
That's right. Also, on that note, rest in peace, Akira Toriyama.
Rest in peace. Thank
you so much for my entire childhood from middle school on. You know, this was it was something I did bond over with my father. He brought home these VHS tapes of this show called Dragon Ball Z. And I think we started out with a couple of the sort of non-canon movies.
Oh, okay.
And back then, only a couple of them were available. And there was like the Tree of Might. And then there was one where they rescue Gohan from a pedophile, basically, with superpowers.
Okay.
Okay, not really a pedophile, but he does get caught. The guy's creepy and he does get kidnapped. Okay. So, and then there was a third one where someone tries to body snatch Goku. But anyway, you know, I formed a lot of friendships around Dragon Ball. We ended up collecting like all the tapes. And so the spines all together formed that image.
Oh.
For each saga. I just got super into it. And the very first real RPG experience I had, other than the Star Trek game that my dad played with me when I was really, really little, before I really learned Dungeons & Dragons, I wanted to play a role-playing game that was based on Dragon Ball. And so a friend of mine, he and I got together and we designed our own Dragon Ball Z role-playing system that was largely based on Diablo II, right?
Oh, that's cool.
At the time. And of course, it was wildly broken and like completely dysfunctional. And in order to better understand how to write that game, I decided to pick up a book on Dungeons and Dragons.
And here we are.
And here we are. And now I go back and I think Dragon Ball is like unwatchable. Like I can't get through it anymore. Like it was definitely good for a kid. It's not good for me now. But the then Team 4STAR made the Dragon Ball abridged, and that was a fantastic series.
I need to watch that because I never watched Dragon Ball Z as a kid, and I don't have the time to do it now.
They're really fun. And I'll say this, the first season has a lot of very 12-year-old infantile humor. But after that, it's like they learn how to write. And
oh, dang.
It gets like a lot better.
Okay.
Pretty quickly until it gets to be like, wow, this is better than the original show. Like, this is great. There's way more attention to character now. So anyway, like I say, rest in peace. Thank you for all of the wonderful things that you created, that inspired me, that distracted me, and that took all my money away.
You know, like you do.
So that will be my only thoughts on him. So you want to take us home?
Let's go. Thank you all so much for joining us for this week's episode of Inspiration Point. We hope that we've given you some thoughts and ideas. And again, refer back to the document that is in the show notes for more in-depth detail that we didn't go into on some of the different points. There are like little paragraphs under each of the like Act 1, Act 2, Act 3 structures. Very worth digging into and looking into all of that. Next time, we're going to dig deeper into the nitty-gritty of stuff, which I'm looking forward to, and we hope that you will join us for that. But until next time, stay inspired.
Goodbye, everybody. And also, one last postscript, okay?
This is like Return of the King, although there's so many endings.
If you make your own copy of this and you fill it out yourself, I will happily review it and comment it for you.
Ooh.
So if that's something you're interested in, I am a teacher. That is my life.
Excellent. Well, if you want to send it to him directly, we're on the Discord. The Discord link is in the show notes. Definitely feel free to toss that at him there.
That'll be fantastic. Okay, bye!
Bye! Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Inspiration Point. If you'd like to support what we do, go and check out our Patreon at patreon.com/inspirationpoint. If you can't support us directly, that's okay. You can also help support us by telling people about the podcast. A little inspiration goes a long way.
Inspiration Point is edited and produced by Tiana Hansen and is distributed by Quest and Chaos. If you like what you hear with us, give Quest and Chaos YouTube or Twitch channels a visit. They play Dungeons and Dragons on a weekly basis and have a bunch of campaigns of Call of Cthulhu, D&D, and board game playthroughs archived on their YouTube.
Join us next week for more inspiration.